Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. We've been listening to President Bush's news conference giving a report card on Iraq that his government is releasing today, that the U.S. government is releasing today as mandated by Congress. Obviously, this is just one issue beginning to mark the end of the Bush-Cheney era. We're seeing that politically by major Republicans being willing to walk away from this policy in some cases. And people are beginning to look ahead in general, including conservatives in the president's base. And so we will talk now about the news conference that we just heard and much more with Weekly Standard editor William Crystal and Charles Dunn, dean of the Robertson School of Government at Regent University in Virginia. Dunn is the editor of a new book called The Future of Conservatism, Conflict and Consensus in the Post-Reagan Era, published by ISI Books. William Crystal is a contributor. So William Crystal, welcome back. And Charles Dunn, welcome to WNYC. Hello.
Hi, Brian. How are you?
Good to be with you.
William Crystal, can you first react to anything in the report?
I mean, I think the benchmarks are obviously an arbitrary bunch of benchmarks written by people here in Washington without much relevance to what was happening on the ground in Iraq in January, let alone what's happened over the last 5-6 months. I think the administration was honest in saying it's a mixed bag politically. I think the media is understating the actual military progress, which has been pretty astounding, I would say, as a supporter of the surge. If you look at the documents that were made to sort of argue for it and to say what could be done over 6 months, Petraeus has done more, actually, pretty amazing. And I think the most important political progress is actually happening on the ground, not in the legislature in Baghdad, which is the flipping of the Sunni tribes in Anbar province and the beginning of splitting of Shia away from the Iranian-backed extremists. So I think Petraeus is doing a pretty fantastic job, and of course I'm a supporter of his and of Bush, and I think Bush was pretty good at the press conference and making the case for giving him a chance.
Well, you say the benchmarks in the bill are largely irrelevant to what's actually going on, what's important to be measured, but what about the two things, for example, that the president mentioned are not going well? The lack of an oil sharing law, and what was the other one? The failure to develop local elections. Aren't those major things that have a lot to do with the future success of working toward peace in Iraq?
Not necessarily. I mean, I'm not expert on whether the oil sharing law would be good or bad. Depends on, I suppose, on the details of it. And I don't imagine that there's a single, there weren't three people in Congress who have the foggiest idea what the substance of that law is. It's just something someone, it's like immigration bill in Congress. Hey, let's have an immigration bill. Well, that would be good. It'd be good to have a sensible solution to immigration. There were a lot of objections to it. It didn't pass. Does that mean that it was wrong that it didn't pass? Does that mean the liberal or conservative objections were wrong? Now, look, I'm not minimizing the fact that it's not a very well-functioning political system there yet. That's not a surprise given the collapse of security, especially in 2006, for which we, the U.S. and the Bush administration, bear considerable responsibility, in my view. And as you know, Brian, I've been a critic of Rumsfeld and of Bush in that respect. Yeah. I do think now with the new strategy, I mean, obviously we should pressure Maliki to do more. We should work with others in the Iraqi government to do more. But again, if the security situation improves, a lot of that's going to be easier to get done. If it doesn't improve, it doesn't really matter what kind of law they pass because everything will collapse. So it still is, it's a war, you know, and the military stuff is the most important.
Is it enough to hang the failure on Rumsfeld? You were an original supporter, even generator of the idea of going to war against Iraq even before 9/11. And yes, there were the WMDs, which weren't there, and Rumsfeld's strategic failures. But there's so much information coming out now about warnings that Iraq was too unstable to be governed easily without Saddam, too sectarian to be governed so easily, all the things that are coming to pass. Are these larger failures of the camp that you're a part of?
No, I don't think the fact that Iraq is a difficult place and has sectarian splits means that you should leave Saddam Hussein in power to slaughter people. I mean, and I'm happy to debate. I mean, I'm willing to accept responsibility for whatever role I played in encouraging, making the case for the war, and I will defend the war. I believe we are better off now, even with the mistakes we made, than we would be if we had left Saddam in power with all that would have implied about his, I believe the sanctions would have come off and he would have reconstituted his weapons programs, etc. But it's a debate that's going to be had for a long time, and it's legitimate for people to say people shouldn't let people like me off easy by just letting us say, you know, Rumsfeld messed it up and it would have been perfect. I certainly don't think it would have been perfect. It's a question of weighing the alternatives, but seriously weighing the alternatives and not just saying, you know, it's been difficult. We've lost people and lots of Iraqis have died, and therefore, obviously, the whole thing is a disaster. You always have to compare it with what the alternative would have been. And then we have to have a serious discussion about moving forward, what could happen. And this could look very different a year from now.
Could look very different a year from now. But let me press it a little bit more, because when you say that we're better off with the war, even the way it's gone, than if we had not fought the war, the government also reports today on the reconstituting of al-Qaeda, a stronger al-Qaeda, as the Washington Post headline puts it today, partly because they've got a safe haven in Pakistan and are regenerating support, regenerating their camps. If the U.S. had focused more militarily on that rather than taking so much attention away from the Afghanistan front and focusing as much on Iraq, might the U.S. not be better off today vis-a-vis al-Qaeda?
I would have done a little more in Afghanistan, but no, it's taken 5.5 years since September 11th for al-Qaeda to possibly get up to something like the ability they had then, and I'm not convinced they do. I think Waziristan's a big problem. That's not a general matter of not, quote, not focusing enough on Afghanistan. I missed all the liberal voices calling for bombing runs into Pakistan in the last 2 or 3 or 4 years, and they wouldn't have been there even if we hadn't been fighting in Iraq. I myself believe that we probably should have pressured Musharraf more and not accepted the DLC cut with the Taliban to give them, in effect, control of western Pakistan, of the mountainous regions out there. I suspect Bush will have to take some action with, you know, some from the air and perhaps special operations in Waziristan, but you cannot allow them to have safe havens, to have sanctuaries. That's the one thing we've learned, I think, over the last 10 years. You know, terrorists can do damage. They can kill people if they're meeting in basements and, you know, chatting, talking over the Internet and planning. You get a London, you get a Madrid. The real big, big danger comes when they have a sanctuary and can plan and organize and train lots of people. That's what led to 9/11, obviously. So I'm alarmed about Waziristan. We've been calling that alarm for the last year. I don't think it has much to do one way or the other with Iraq. It has to do with us, and nor even with Afghanistan, frankly, where things have gone pretty well, but with Musharraf's unwillingness or inability to be as tough as he might be. We may just have to step in and say, regardless of what Musharraf wants or doesn't want, and I suspect he couldn't care less if we went in there with and tried to take out the terror camps. He just doesn't want to be asked to bless it. We may just have to do that, and that's the world we live in, and these, you know, al-Qaeda wasn't going away one way or the other. I think on the whole we've had a pretty good year, 5.5 years, frankly, in the war on terror. I mean, most experts whom you had on your show, you know, in September, October, November of 2001, I would wager, would have thought there would have been more attacks here in Europe, elsewhere, even elsewhere in the Middle East, over the last 5.5 years. But I don't want to be complacent, and, you know, and obviously Waziristan is a real challenge.
One more thing on this, and Charles Dunn, I don't mean to ignore you. You can react to this too, but William Crystal obviously is such a major player on this particular aspect. I want to actually replay the question that the reporter Helen Thomas asked the president and ask you one of the things that she brings up here.
President, you started this war. It's a war of your choosing. And you can end it alone today at this point. Bring in peacekeepers, UN peacekeepers. 2 million Iraqis have fled their country as refugees. 2 million more are displaced. Thousands and thousands are dead. Don't you understand? We brought the al-Qaeda into Iraq.
So right at the end there, William, she asks, if the president didn't create Iraq as a haven for al-Qaeda by launching the war, and he didn't answer it directly, but did we not do that, in your opinion?
Well, there were ties with Iraq, obviously, before the war, ties with al-Qaeda. The Saddam Hussein government had ties with al-Qaeda before the
Minimal
war.
Minimal ties, right?
No, I wouldn't say that. Serious ties, and they could have gotten a lot serious in the last 4 years as the sanctions came off, assuming they would have, and the no-fly zone went away, which I don't believe we could have sustained. There was a lot of resentment, you may recall, and a lot of TV and radio here in the U.S. devoted to the suffering we were inflicting on Iraqis by maintaining the sanctions and the bombing, so the no-fly zones. So, no, but now we have, Iraq has become the central front in the war on terror, and we can't demand it. I think Bush's answer was perfectly straightforward on that. Incidentally, Bush can't end the war. I mean, no one thinks that. The idea that we're going to pull out and UN peacekeeping troops are going to go in, I mean, who's going to welcome them in there? And so that's not a serious alternative.
My guest on WNYC, our Weekly Standard editor, William Crystal, also a contributor to Time Magazine as a columnist and now a contributor to a new book called The Future of Conservatism, Conflict and Consensus in the Post-Reagan Era, published by ISI Books. The editor is also with us. He is Charles Dunn, Dean of the Robertson School of Government at Regent University in Virginia. And Dean Dunn, do you want to comment on anything that we've addressed so far before I go on to ask you something specific from the book?
Yes, Monday morning quarterbacking is easy. But we have to recognize that right now, with our Monday morning quarterbacking of President Bush, his poll numbers are quite low, a lot of concern about his leadership. But he's not the first president, nor the first president in wartime, to have low poll numbers. History will give us a much better account, clearer vision of whether he has done right. It's easy to criticize right now. That's the first point. Second point is that democracy, as Winston Churchill understood, is messy at best. Trying to create a democracy is even more messy. And so we're trying to create a democracy in the midst of wartime, which is quite a horrendous undertaking, and we're having a degree of success in doing it.
But now you call it quite a horrendous undertaking, and obviously history will judge in the long run whether we had some tough years here and then things started turning up for the better as a result of this policy, and we have no way to know. But the public in our democracy has to make judgments now about policies, about candidates, whatever, based on their best judgments at the moment. We were told before the war that it was going to be a cakewalk with Iraqis throwing flowers at U.S. troops. Now you're saying, well, of course it's horrendous and so difficult to create a democracy where there was no democracy. Is that revisionism that suits your purposes?
One could surely say that there is a degree of revisionism here. The point that I would draw out is that when a president faces low poll numbers, he has difficulty, of course, making his case, getting the American people to follow and to understand. My assessment of his press conference was that he handled the issues clearly and with, I think, a pretty good sense of integrity in trying to get the American people to see the long term. Right now, we're focused very much in a short-sighted way on what's happening. And he, I think, tried to shift the burden of thought from the short-sighted to the long-sighted view of this, and to get us to understand that this is not something that we can handle very quickly, and that we're going to have to look at the long term. And several times he made important points about we've only had the troops in place that the general requested within the past 2 or 3 weeks. We can't expect immediate results. So I thought that there was, in a way, he was kind of like a professor teaching a class here, trying to get the class to see the long term of things.
Is that not a paternalistic view of the relationship between the president and the American people?
There's always that. I have a book recently out called The Seven Laws of Presidential Leadership, and one of the laws is the law of rhetoric. And that law of rhetoric, getting the people to understand why you're leading and where you are leading them. And so this was an exercise in the law of rhetoric. If I were to fault President Bush, he should have done this type of thing earlier, and I think he would have had much more success. But given he's done it now, and so I'd give him high marks for what he did.
Well, your book, the new book, is framed around the idea of a post-Reagan era with consensus and conflict among conservatives. Is another Reagan moment possible anytime soon?
No. Ronald Reagan was a great leader for his era. There are a lot of Ronald Reagan wannabes, but none of them can be. No one embodies all of the strengths of Ronald Reagan. We have to remember certain things about Ronald Reagan. quite an articulate president, but he too had, shall we call them, Bush moments when he was quite low in popularity. People crucified and vilified him, just as they're doing President Bush now. That's the lot of being a president, whether you're a Bill Clinton or Ronald Reagan or George W. Bush. That happens. It's par for the course. The way I look at it now is that if conservatives and Republicans have to pick a time when they're going to be down and depressed, now is the time to be that way, and to have an intense debate about the future of conservatism and the future of the Republican Party. It's a long time between now and the next election. If we look at the top three or four Republican candidates, they all run very well against the top Democratic candidates at a time when you would expect the top Democratic candidates to blow the Republicans out of the water in the polls, but that's not the case. So actually, conservatives and Republicans are in a much better position now than most people think. I've just been in the midst of 50-some interviews, radio talk shows around the nation promoting this book, mm-hmm. The Future of Conservatism. And I'm hearing a lot of despair and despondency. But my response to that is that I think this is really going to turn into a high moment for conservatives and Republicans once they get through the debate and select their leader.
William Crystal, do you agree that it's going to turn into a high moment for conservatives or conservatism? And I don't just mean whether a Republican is elected president next year, but is the American public getting fed up, a lot of independents, a lot of people in the middle, getting fed up with what they may see as doctrinaire conservatism, maybe the president's position on embryonic stem cell research, his flying back from vacation because the Terry Schiavo case was deemed to be an emergency, the willingness to turn Social Security over to Wall Street, which turned out to be very unpopular, and the war. Are these things now starting to be at least perceived as an ideological step too far for the American people in the center?
And the immigration bill, which was a dogmatic, doctrinaire, conservative thing, and the Medicare prescription drug benefit.
Which were clearly not, right.
Yeah, so, I mean, let's be serious. He's had a mixed record from a conservative point of view. He's had a mixed successes and failures. I don't know whether it's going to be a high watermark or not. A lot depends on Iraq. I'd say on economic policy, I feel that sort of basic conservative doctrine of cutting taxes and free trade, for that matter, has stimulated economic growth here and around the world. On the social and moral and cultural issues, those are very complicated. There's probably overreaching on both sides, but I would be happy to go to the American public on the sort of, do you prefer or not, the basic direction a Roberts Alito-type Supreme Court will go. Everything depends on Iraq. I think there's no big ideological movement one way or the other among the public. Obviously, 2006 was a repudiation of Bush and of the Republican Congress. That was due to some of that repudiation was deserved. Some of it was perhaps just a kind of tiredness after 12 years of Republican Congress. 08's a big election. I think it's very up in the air. Right now, you'd probably have to bet slightly on the Democrats just because 06 was such a good Democratic year and Bush is so unpopular, and history would suggest that a president so unpopular, if he stays this unpopular, makes it harder for his party to keep the White House. But Charles is right also that we have Republican candidates like Giuliani and Thompson, Romney, who McCain too, and who are really not associated with the Bush administration much. Mm-hmm. So when you get a forward-looking election, a forward-looking referendum in mid-late 2008, I think it's a very close call and very up in the air. A lot will depend on Iraq, I think a lot is up, a lot at stake in this election, and a lot is up. It's just uncertain, really.
Looking beyond Bush and Cheney, Dean Dunn, do you see specific fault lines among conservatives for determining who the next Republican presidential nominee will be? Or beyond that, to ideological fault lines or, issue-based passions within the conservative movement?
Yes, you've asked an excellent question. Conservatism is quite complex. There are economic, political, social, religious, neoconservatives, all sorts of conservatives, and they need a coming together. Ronald Reagan was able to bring conservatives together under a common umbrella. Right now, the debate is who out there is best able, as Reagan did, to bring conservatives together and get them under a common agenda. That's what the heart of this debate is about. So I agree with Bill regarding where we are now. First, we would add to him, we have a lame duck president. Every lame duck president suffers in similar ways to what President Bush is suffering from right now. He's leading from political weakness because he is a lame duck. If we look back at 2006, let's, for example, speculate if we could have removed the Iraq war from the 2006 election debate, Republicans and conservatives would still be in charge of the Congress. That was the principal turning point. There were others, but that was the principal one that led to a democratically controlled Congress. So looking forward then, we need to see who's going to emerge to bring together the various wings of conservatism. And if we look, for example, Rudy Giuliani spoke at Regent University 2 weeks ago. He got a standing ovation in front of a religiously and socially conservative audience that a lot of people would have thought, hey, there's no way that could happen. We see Thompson about to jump into the race, and he appears like he's going to be able to coalesce various wings of conservatism about him. So this is a healthy debate that's taking place right now that could lead to the success of conservatives and Republicans next year.
Dean Dunn, do you think that Rudy Giuliani is nominatable in the Republican primaries?
Oh, yes. Most definitely he is. First, we have 10 and soon to be apparently 11 candidates out there. They're going to divide a lot of votes in Iowa, New Hampshire, and those early primary and caucus states. And he's going to be able to come in with a significant plurality of votes, possibly even winning some of those states. And then as candidates fall by the wayside, as they surely will, he's going to have the opportunity to emerge clearly as one of the top two or three front runners. And, of course, right now in the polls, he is the front runner among the leading Republican contenders.
We'll continue in a minute with Charles Dunn, editor of The Future of Conservatism, Conflict and Consensus in the Post-Reagan Era, and William Kristol, editor of The Weekly Standard and a contributor to The Future of Conservatism. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Stay with us.
Al-Qaeda in Iraq has sworn allegiance to Osama bin Laden. And you know, the guys who had perpetuated the attacks on America, obviously the guys on the airplane are dead. And the commanders, many of those are either dead or in captivity, like Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. But the people in Iraq, Al-Qaeda in Iraq has sworn allegiance to Osama bin Laden. And we need to take Al-Qaeda in Iraq seriously, just like we need to take Al-Qaeda anywhere in the world seriously.
President Bush, from his news conference just a short time ago, as heard live here on WNYC, and as he unveiled the interim progress report on 18 benchmarks regarding the troop surge as mandated by Congress. We're talking about this and the future of conservatism with Charles Dunn from Regent University, editor of a new book called The Future of Conservatism, Conflict and Consensus in the Post-Reagan Era, and a contributor to the book, the Weekly Standard editor, William Kristol. We have phone calls and comments coming in. Let's take a few of those. Our number 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. Post your comments on our webpage, WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. And Joe in Bloomfield, you're on WNYC. Hello, Joe.
Hi, Brian. Thank you for taking my call.
Thank you.
Yeah, so it's really upsetting to hear these two individuals speaking right now after the president gave this speech. First of all, it sounds like the conservative cheerleading to help baby Bush try to bring up his poll numbers when it's obvious that the American people are just completely against his policies, the war in general. As Abraham Lincoln said, that all of the people can be fooled some of the time, but not all the people.
But Joe, don't do political analysis. If you have a question on the substance of the issues that you want to challenge my guests on, go ahead.
Yes, I want to challenge them on two issues. First of all, Kristol said before the war that it was a myth that there was antagonism between the Sunnis and Shiites. And second, the other individual said that we have to let history decide this. So what do we do? Do we just disregard the deaths of the American soldiers that are occurring right now how many are being, how many limbs and lives are being lost. Right now, the deaths of Americans is already going up to 4,000.
Joe, I'm going to leave it there. Thank you very much. And William Crystal, it's interesting. A number of people are calling in with it, basically the same question about something you once said. And someone posted it on the website here, so I'm going to read this quote, and you tell me if this is accurate from you. There's been a certain amount of pop sociology in America that the Shia can't get along with the Sunni, and the Shia in Iraq just want to establish some kind of Islamic fundamentalist regime. There's almost no evidence of that at all. Iraq's always been very secular. You saying it in 2003. Is that an accurate quote?
I have no idea. I think I said it to Terry Gross. I mean, I assume she transcribed, her staff transcribed it accurately, and it's now become famous, so I don't go back and listen to my tapes. I stand absolutely by the statement. The fact is, most people in Iraq are secular. I think that's just an empirical fact. Oh, secular is too strong. They're Islamic, but they're not fundamentalists. The Sunnis, in fact, I certainly people like me underestimated, I think, the resistance of the Sunnis to being governed by Shia and their willingness to be hospitable and tolerant of al-Qaeda setting up camp in Sunni safe havens, especially in Anbar. That's now, they've now turned against al-Qaeda. But above all, the Shia resisted sectarian war for 2.5 years. Under Sistani's leadership, they behaved pretty well, you know. They finally broke into February 2006, and it really got out of hand. Iran, obviously, has been fishing in very troubled waters. I don't think any of us thought it was going to be a paradise. So most countries in the West weren't paradises at different times, and they've had a heck of a lot of sectarian and religious violence here, and I'm aware of that. But I would stick with my basic contention that you cannot look at Iraq and say that place is just, you know, they're going to slaughter each other forever. They have no Iraqi national identity. They're utterly incapable of working with each other or living with each other. And I was making also the point that just as an empirical matter, there's a lot of intermarriage between Sunni and Shia, a lot of a mixture within tribes of Sunni and Shia. Baghdad is very much of a mixed city. Look, so was Sarajevo, and that ended. And I think one reason, and these things can get inflamed, and they can have very bad effects. And that's happened to some degree in Iraq. And maybe we could have stopped it. Maybe some of it was inevitable once Saddam's brutal hand was lifted. But I stick with my basic contention that people who were saying you couldn't liberate Saddam, you couldn't have an acceptable outcome, were wrong.
Brian in the Bronx, you're on WNYC. Hello, Brian.
Hello. I just want to comment on Crystal's statement that that we are better off after the invasion of Iraq. Who is the we? There are responsible reports of 500,000 deaths subsequent to the invasion. Times reports today $10 billion a month. He's simply repeating what he wants to be the case. I mean, I think if a UFO landed tomorrow, he would say it implies we need to attack Iran. There's no calculus there. We're not better off. We've lost treasure. We've lost lives, and so many have died in Iraq.
You want to go back, Bill Crystal, to how you think we're better off?
I think it's, of course, you can't prove it because we have to compare the situation now with what it would have been if we hadn't gone in, and obviously that's speculative, and I'm not going to claim I can prove that it wouldn't have been better. Maybe Saddam would have remained very weak. We could have kept the sanctions on. We wouldn't have lost the lives we've lost. He might not have killed that many people over the intervening time in Iraq, et cetera, et cetera. He wouldn't have been able to strengthen terror groups. I can't prove that, so I don't really want to belabor the point. I think if you look, step back and say, what were the risks? What would the risks have been of leaving him there? With, I believe, the sanctions getting off and the inspectors coming out and what he might have been able to do over the next 4 years, I still think one can reasonably make the case that we are now better off. Look, the lives are serious, and that is the strongest objection, obviously, to the war. We've lost 3,500 soldiers dead, 20,000 plus wounded, many, many Iraqis have been killed. That is by far the strongest objection and the strongest, case that this was a mistake, and I don't minimize that. I think the treasure argument is frankly trivial. We're an unbelievably rich country. We're spending a very low percentage, less than 1% of our GDP, on this war. If it's worth fighting, it's worth fighting for this cause. If it's not worth fighting, it wouldn't be worth fighting, even if it were 1/10 of the cost. And all the critics know this, incidentally. No one, if I told you, the person who just called, hey, we could have, if this war had been fought at 1/10 the cost, would he support it? No, and he shouldn't. If he thinks it's wrong, it's wrong.
William,
the cost issue is really a red herring, I think.
Nicholas Kristof wrote in his New York Times column today that if the money spent on the Iraq war were not spent, we'd have enough money to cover everybody with national health insurance for 30 years.
Oh, that's just ludicrous. Did we cover everyone with national health insurance before the Iraq war? Our budget deficit is the lowest it's been in 5 years. It's lower than it was before the Iraq war. We are 20% wealthier as a country than we are well, 15-18% wealthier as a country than we were the day the Iraq war began. If people want to make a case against the Iraq war, they are absolutely entitled to, and there are serious moral and political arguments that the war was wrong. I don't agree with them, but they're serious arguments. The cost argument is an unworthy argument for the critics to make.
Dean Dunn, I'm sure you want to talk more about the book, and I want to go back to the 10 canons of conservatism in your introduction, and I'm going to actually read them for the listeners that you have laid out: continuity, authority, community, deity, personal responsibility, democracy, property, liberty, meritocracy, and antipathy to communism abroad. Some of those you frame in opposition to other values. For example, you write that personal responsibility is more important than individual rights. Why do you oppose those two?
It's important to understand those in the context of history. Both liberals and conservatives believe in personal responsibility and in individual rights. They have to place different emphasis upon them. And even within conservatism, some conservatives place relatively more importance on individual rights than personal responsibility. We can see from the context of public policy, if we flash into history, with Franklin Roosevelt, he brought about a transition in America from an emphasis on personal responsibility to individual rights, and individual rights have become much more important part of public policy in America since Franklin Roosevelt's day in the Great Depression and World War II. Many conservatives hearken back to prior to that time, when there was greater emphasis on personal responsibility and the actions of the local community, the neighborhood, the churches, in solving problems at the local level. That's something that, for example, Ronald Reagan addressed. So these 10 canons, as we call them, of conservatism, give us insight into conservatism and the differences within conservatism and between conservatism and liberalism.
You also write that conservatives value liberty more than equality. And a liberal might say, well, that's a fine philosophy for the more privileged among us because you're not hurt as much by inequality. Why do conservatives value liberty over equality?
Well, let's look, for example, at the Republican and Democratic Party platforms beginning, let's say, in 1980 with Ronald Reagan against Jimmy Carter, then 1984, Democrats in Mondale versus Ronald Reagan, and move forward. The word liberty, or the word freedom, occurs much more frequently in the Republican Party platforms than in the Democratic Party platforms. It's a matter of relative emphasis. Conservatives have historically placed more emphasis upon the idea of liberty, and Democrats much more emphasis on the idea of equality. That's not to say that all Democrats oppose liberty or all conservatives oppose equality. It's a matter of relative emphasis. And therein is the dynamic, and it's a healthy dynamic in America, a tug of war between those two. We need both liberty and equality to make democracy work. If you have total liberty and no equality, well, that doesn't work in a democracy. And if you have total equality and no liberty, that doesn't work in a democracy either. So a dynamic and a healthy tension is there, and conservatives and liberals place different emphasis upon them.
So, Dean Dunn, in our final minute here, do you want to go for some common ground and posit that both conservative principles and liberal principles contribute to make America the great nation that it is, or aren't you willing to do that?
Oh, I'm definitely willing to do that. That's the health of politics in America. And let's put it simply this way. Americans are like a bell-shaped curve. Most Americans are in the center of that bell. The center of gravity of power in the Republican Party is to the right of center. Center of gravity of power in the Democratic Party is to the left of center. If you're a Republican, you want to become president, you got to attack hard right to get the nomination, and then you got to attack back to the left to get to the center where most Americans are. And it's the reverse of that in the Democratic Party. So there's this healthy dynamic and tug of war that really makes America great. And there's got to be this respect between conservatives and liberals that both are vital to the success of our democracy.
Their new book is called The Future of Conservatism, Conflict and Consensus in the Post-Reagan Era, published by ISI Books. They really are a whole group of contributors, various conservative thinkers and writers. The editor is Charles Dunn, dean at Regent University in Virginia, and one of the contributors is Weekly Standard editor Bill Kristol. A pleasure to have both of you with us. Thank you both very, very much.
Thank you, Brian. You. Be well.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC.